I kind of geeked out this week. Maybe some of you did too. Anybody else geek out? You're like, let me wait until you tell me why. The Falcon Heavy launch was this week. I got to tell you, I was amazed. I wanted to be an astronaut many, many moons ago. And so anything about the space program gets me kind of excited. And then I hadn't really kept up with SpaceX and all that sort of thing, but there was a little blurb online, hey, Falcon Heavy launched today. I'm like, okay, let me look. And I watched a video about it, and it had a dramatization of how it would happen. And I thought, really? That's crazy. It's not going to work that way. I got to watch it now. So I did. Plus, the last time, I guess, one of these things happened, it blew up on the launch pad, and Elon Musk was like, please don't let it blow up. So I said, there's always a possibility of that, too. So it was a win-win. It's either going to work or it wasn't. But I had to watch it. And I'm telling you, I was amazed. Now, if you've ever been to a launch, it's pretty remarkable. The power of those aircraft, or spacecraft, I guess is the better word, it's just there. We, years ago, went up, and we're pretty far away from the launch pad at Kennedy Space Center, and even then, you could first see and then feel kind of the sound and the sonic waves coming at you as that vehicle, it was a space shuttle, so it was a long time ago, took off. This is right now, the Falcon Heavy rocket is kind of the next thing. It's not NASA, it's a private company, SpaceX and all that sort of thing, but this is the cool part. It had a central rocket and then two boosters on the outside. And it takes off, and it would first jettison the two outside boosters, and then a little bit further into the flight, it would jettison the central booster, and they were to return to Earth. Now, if you remember back in the old days, when something returned to Earth, it just splashed down in the middle of the ocean, had a parachute, and you went out and got it. Not anymore. No. Those bad boys were designed to pilot themselves back to Earth. The two outer ones to land on twin landing pads at Kennedy Space Center, and the central one, because it was a little further into the flight before it went off, was to land at a drone ship in the middle of the ocean. And I thought, this is nutso, until I saw it. I'm thinking, I can't believe that this is going to happen, but sure enough, they had cameras on all this stuff. So the two outside ones, they go away, and there's cameras on it. At the time on the screen, there was the two cameras on the outside booster, the camera on the central booster, and the other one just kind of showing the trajectory. And they came down, the two outside boosters, almost simultaneously, touched down perfectly at Kennedy Space Center. And I went, oh, that is amazing. And then I was excited because now I've got to see. Now, that was pretty impressive, but that's solid ground. How is that central thing going to land at a drone ship in the middle of the ocean? Sure enough, there's a camera on the ship, and it shows the central thing coming down, and you can see the kind of the platform in the water, and then it switches to the cameras on the drone ship, and they made this kind of disclaimer. They said, you know, as it gets close, the power of the kind of the landing thrusters will vibrate and might knock out the camera. And sure enough, before it landed, it did. And so all day, many of us, like me, are Googling, what happened to the central core? What happened to the central core? Apparently, we lost the central core. I didn't. I mean, it doesn't bother me at all, but nonetheless. I mean, I was like, this is remarkable. It was really fascinating stuff to think that you know, the advances in technology that they were able to do that. And of course, kind of the weird thing is, because it's SpaceX, Elon Musk put his personal Tesla Roadster in the cone of the ship, and it is out in space with a rocket man, space-suited man in the driver's seat, cameras. And those shots, by the way, as long as they're going, are live. It's going to be out there for a long time. It's supposed to get into some orbit that's going to shift it around the moon and possibly come close, I mean the sun, and possibly come close to Mars, because ultimately that's kind of where they're going, assuming it survives all the other stuff. Isn't that remarkable? I think it's pretty fascinating. It's interesting how, you know, all of this stuff that we do with science usually starts with questions, doesn't it? They start asking questions. You know, there was somebody somewhere years ago that said, can we go into space? And then can we put someone on the moon? And then they begin to ask the smaller questions about the particulars of how they can take this big idea of we're going to put someone in space, we're going to put someone on the moon, we're going to put someone on Mars. And they begin to ask the littler questions, the smaller questions, break it down into pieces, and get the steps necessary to get to the big idea, the big conclusion, the big YouTube video launch that people like me geek out over. So I thought I would use that idea today to help us ask some questions, not because we're going to go to Mars, but because we want to make an outer space destination. Not that heaven's in outer space, but nonetheless, we all have a place we want to go. We believe God desires that all of us will spend forever with Him. And to get there, I think there are some questions. There are kind of some essential ideas, questions and answers that we need to deal with. So over the next several weeks leading up to Easter, we're going to be looking at some of these questions. This is in, or will be, starting Wednesday. Not only is it Valentine's Day, it's also Ash Wednesday, which is the official beginning of Lent. And for many denominations, for many in different religious traditions, that's a pretty important day. That's a pretty important 40-day process that they begin to observe. And so we're going to use this Lenten period to look at some of these questions and see if we can kind of get some answers that will help us better understand who Jesus is, what it is that we're about as followers of Jesus, and ultimately what the hope that He has provided for us is. And we'll culminate with it on Easter Sunday. Okay, so that's where we're going. Now, where are we going to start? Question numero uno, most important question. The most important question, I think, in the entire universe. Who is Jesus? I think that makes all the difference in the world. In fact, it's a question that Jesus asked of His closest followers. And that's where we're going to spend some time today. We're going to be in the Gospel of Matthew, Matthew's account of the life of Jesus, the first book of what we call the New Testament. Matthew chapter 16 is where this account is. We're going to put most of the verses up on the screen, but we invite you to follow along, whether you brought your Bible or you want to grab one under the seats or you have your own electronic device to follow along. In Matthew chapter 16, beginning in verse 13, is where we're going to start this passage. And in Matthew 16, we're told, when Jesus came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, He asked His disciples, "Who do people say the Son of Man is?" Let me stop right there. You know, often we look at these things and there are locations in there, we just sort of gloss over them. But I think this is a really fascinating location, Caesarea Philippi. Now, some of us, four of you that are here, went to Israel. We did not go to Caesarea Philippi. We went to Caesarea, which is on the coast. Caesarea Philippi is in a place that you might know or is referred to as the Golan Heights. It's actually on the way or just on the lower slopes leading up to the tallest mountain in Israel, Mount Hermon. In fact, we saw it our first morning we woke up in Israel. It was clear and we could see it way off in the distance. Mount Hermon goes up over 2,800 meters. To give you a comparison, those of us who have been there, the city of Jerusalem is about 750 meters above sea level. So it's by far a much larger mountain. Apparently, we were told it's the ski resort of Israel. I didn't know you could ski there, but I guess you can on Mount Hermon. And so it's over there. So it's to the north, about 25 to 30 miles north of the Sea of Galilee. And Jesus is in that area going toward that city, Caesarea Philippi. Now, that's the Roman name. As you can see in the name, you see Caesar. A lot of these place names in that period of time, they would pay homage to Caesar because they wanted Caesar to like them. And you can see because of the Philippi, it separates itself with those kind of last names to these cities from other Caesarea type cities. Caesarea Philippi is a remarkable place. It was called many different things. It actually shows up in the Old Testament a few times. The tribe of Dan is in that part of the world. And Jehoshaphat, who was in trouble for setting up idols on the high places, this is probably about where he did that very thing, for those of you who are into your Old Testament history. Jesus takes His disciples there. Now, in that day and time, this was a pagan city. This was not a Christian city. It wasn't a Jewish city. It was very pagan. In fact, I have a picture of a kind of an artist depiction of what would have been at this city, Caesarea Philippi, in the first century. And the primary feature were these two temples. The middle one in this picture is called the Sanctuary of Pan. Now, Pan was kind of a Greek god, and interestingly enough, you think of him as the half-man, half-goat that plays the flute, but he was a god that was feared, and that's actually from his name is where we get our English word panic, for lack of a better way of doing it. So that gives you an idea of the kind of personality this fellow had. The reason this was significant is because in that central temple, the sanctuary of Pan, you could go in and a stream flowed out from this mountain. As the snow that was mostly of the time on Mount Hermon would melt and seep into the inner parts of the mountain, the fresh water would then kind of bubble up. At one time, it would actually flow out of the mouth of this cave that central sanctuary sits blocking the view of. And it was one of the primary sources, Josephus says, the primary source of the Jordan River, which is very important in Israel's history, very important in that part of the world. This is a very fertile area because of the water that came out. And you could go into this cave, and it was thought that this area, once the water kind of receded a bit and wasn't constantly flowing out over the mouth of the cave, it was this huge abyss of water. They thought it was a bottomless pit. So that in that day, they thought this cave that they put this temple in the front of was actually the entrance to the underworld, the entrance to Hades. And the gods, during winter, would go into this cave, could go down into that bottomless pit, into the underworld, and sleep for the winter. And then in spring, the sign of their return would be, as the snow melted, as the water rose, and the spring began to flow, as the flowers bloomed, they would come out. And so they would gather at the mouth of this cave to do all sorts of, well, pagan things, to honor these pagan gods, to encourage them to come on out and make the world warmer and prettier. Sounds like fun, huh? Now, this is where Jesus is. Now, I told you, I think this is important, and we'll see as we go through this passage why I think this location is particularly important. Back to Matthew chapter 16, we left off at the end of verse 13. Jesus asked the question, who do people say the Son of Man is? Now, even in that question, there's a bit of a hint. Who do people say the Son of Man is? Now, Son of Man is a title, as you would expect. Jesus, in this instance, is using for himself. It's something that we often talk about, many people talk about. They call Jesus the Son of God or the Son of Man. But this title has its ties to the Old Testament, namely Daniel chapter 7, where Daniel sees a vision and he says, one like a Son of Man coming with the clouds. In fact, let me just read a few verses from that. It's just a couple of verses. Daniel 7, 13 and 14. This is what it says. In my vision at night, Daniel has this incredible vision. I looked, and there before me was one like a Son of Man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days. Who's the Ancient of Days? That would be God, the Father, God the Father. He approached the Ancient of Days. Who's allowed to approach the Ancient of Days? Nobody. But this one like a Son of Man approaches the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. And notice the Ancient of Days gives him authority, glory, and sovereign power. All peoples, nations, and men of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. So when Jesus asked, who do people say the Son of Man is? Who do you think he thinks he is? I think he's bringing up this Old Testament imagery to mind. Now, that's not the only place that phrase occurs. Ezekiel uses the phrase the Son of Man in different things, but that is a very loaded term as it refers to Daniel chapter 7. It says, who do people say the Son of Man is? And then the disciples give him their answer. They replied, some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others, Jeremiah or one of the prophets. Well, that's a pretty broad answer, right? Non-specific, but also being specific. This is like, you remember when you'd get that essay question in high school and you didn't really know the answer, you just threw a lot of words as the answer and hope that one of them was close to right and you'd get partial credit? And sometimes you put so many words down that said nothing that your teacher thought, wow, that's really something, and gave you full credit. That's kind of the answer I feel like this is. You know, some people say this and that and the other. John the Baptist, obviously been beheaded, killed. Maybe Jesus has come back. He was a pretty significant figure, John the Baptist, in that day and area. Elijah, the forerunner of the Messiah. Not the Messiah himself, but the one who would come before. John the Baptist, the spirit of Elijah on him. Maybe Jesus is Elijah. Or even Jeremiah, The first of the second book of the prophets in the Hebrew canon, the way they organize their Bible, what we call the Old Testament, and also called the weeping prophet, because of the conflict and the trouble that Jesus had, the people trying to come after him. Maybe you're just kind of a reincarnation of Jeremiah, trying to give a message, but the authorities are always coming down on you. Maybe one of those. Now, if we were to go out on the streets of Key Largo or any place and say, who do you think Jesus is? What are some of the answers you think you'd hear? And this is the audience participation part of the sermon. You are allowed to speak in church. Isn't that exciting? A good teacher. Some people would say, yes, Jesus is a good teacher. What else? A prophet of some sort? Any other ideas? Some people might say Son of God, God. Lunatic. Well, there's something. Good man. Seemed to be a good man. Some people might not even know who he is. That'd be interesting, even in our world, but I think that's probably more likely than we expect since we're sitting in church world today. And there are a lot of answers people might give. Who is Jesus? Who do you think Jesus is? And our culture has a lot of answers to that, from the ones that we would maybe ascribe to, like somebody said, the Son of God, the Messiah, the Savior, all the way to, he's a myth, he's a legend, it's a manufactured tales of his life and death and the miracles he worked. There's a broad spectrum that could be said. In fact, one of the things that I think is fascinating is to look at, I really think of it as C.S. Lewis first, but Josh McDowell probably wrote the thing that popularized this line of thinking, and that's what Chuck said a minute ago, lunatic, that when you look at Jesus, there are places where he doesn't leave a lot of wiggle room in some ways, and that's where this line of reasoning comes, that some people would say, well, Jesus is a good teacher, or a good person, or a moral person, or a one that could teach us some lessons that we could learn. And as Lewis looked at it, in fact, I'm just going to read the quote for you because he writes way better than I talk. He said this, "I am trying here to prevent anyone saying the really foolish thing that people often say about him, that I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God. This is the one thing we must not say. A man who was merely a man and said the sort of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic on the level with a man who says he's a poached egg, which is quite fascinating, or else he would be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool, you can spit at him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us, and he did not intend to. Now it seems to me obvious that he was neither a lunatic nor a fiend, and consequently, however strange or terrifying or unlikely it may seem, I have to accept the view that he was and is God." That was C.S. Lewis's way of looking at some of the things that we've said. Who do people say that he is? Now, ultimately, I would suggest that people come up with these other claims about Jesus, because when you get to the conclusion that Lewis drew, that he is, in fact, what I believe the Bible portrays him to be, God incarnate, King of Kings and Lord of Lords, we're not left with many choices about what we can do with him. But as long as we can keep him at arm's distance, as long as we can make him something less than that, I can have some choice in the matter. And so the people in Jesus' day, as he asked his disciples, "Who do people say that I am?" wanted to keep that distance, wanted to leave their options open with this very popular, traveling, miracle-working, teaching rabbi. And so Jesus wants to ratchet up the pressure a little bit. He's given them kind of the easy question, who do those people say that I am? And now he asks the pointed question that I think all of us will one day have to answer. And Jesus turns to them in the next verse and says, "But you, who do you say that I am?" And Simon Peter answered, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." Peter got it right. That's what we usually end up here. Wow, Peter got it right. That's awesome. Yes, it's awesome. Great thing. Peter gives the answer. Now let's think about this in the broader context for just a second. How long had this been going on? How long had Jesus spent with them? Maybe we think a couple years now. We're Matthew 16. We're kind of later on into his ministry. We're not in the beginning. He's been around them a while. He's seen him work some miracles. He's heard his teachings. And Jesus in this moment, I think, strategically chose to ask that question. He could have asked this question of them at any point along the way. But I think he waited because, being God in the flesh, he knew that maybe finally they were going to get it right. Maybe finally it began to dawn on them. Because in that day and time, there was messianic expectation everywhere. Israel couldn't wait for the Messiah, because when the Messiah showed up, he would liberate them from Rome. He would liberate them from oppression. They had lived much of their history with somebody else calling the shots. And they were God's chosen people. They had been given his word, his promises, his law. They observed faithfully through the temple, the sacrificial system that God gave them, that came down from Sinai to Moses, that they had lived out all these years, waiting for the time when God would say, "Good job, Israel. You've got it right. Now I'm going to liberate you." And in the midst of that culture, different people had come along and asserted themselves as messianic, as messiahs. And inevitably, what would happen is Rome would hear wind of it, and Rome would dispatch soldiers, and Rome would dispatch with the would-be Messiah. Crucify, execute, get rid of them. And so the disciples, when Jesus first comes along, while they're anxious to believe, they're just going to wait and see how this whole thing works out. Because maybe he's just one of the other pretenders that's come along. Maybe he's one that isn't quite up to what God really has for this Messiah. And so in this moment, at this place, Jesus asks this question: "Who do you say?" And Peter, I think answering for the group, but being the mouthpiece because Peter liked to talk, said, "You are the Christ, you are the Son of the living God." And Jesus replied in verse 17, "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for this was not revealed to you by man, but by my Father in heaven." Great verse for a lot of reasons. You know, just real quickly on that, one of the things that this reminds me of, and we need to talk about for just a few minutes, is the fact that, you know, we talked last week, our job, partly, is to go, right? KGG at FBC, knowing, growing, and going, right? All that stuff. We need to go to fulfill the Great Commission. We need to tell others about Jesus and who he is and what he has done for us. But no matter how much we go, no matter what our arguments are, we cannot argue somebody, we cannot out-logic somebody into faith in Christ. We can have very compelling arguments. Hey, you guys going now? Okay. Everybody wave goodbye. Okay. You can't outthink somebody into being a Christian. And I've taken Evangelism Explosion. I've taken the Southern Baptist knockoff of EE called CWT. I've done different things. I've learned different ways to present my faith. But I can't sit down with somebody and say, you know, I'm smarter than them, and I'm just going to think circles around them. In the end, they're going to believe in Jesus. That's not how it happened. Peter didn't come to this confession because he figured it out. Jesus said, "Flesh and blood did not reveal this to you. You didn't come up with this on your own. You didn't think through this, but my Father in heaven revealed it to you." One of the things we have to remember, our job is to go. Our job is to tell, to proclaim the gospel. But it's God's responsibility to do the behind-the-scenes work in the heart of a human being, to draw them to himself. And Peter comes to this great realization, this revelation may be better, because of the work of the Holy Spirit in his life. "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for this was not revealed to you by man, but by my Father in heaven. And I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overcome it. I will give you the keys to the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. Oh boy. Now this is exciting. What does all that mean? I'm so glad you asked. It's tough. I mean, this is one of those passages that in one religious tradition, the idea that Peter as the rock, as the kind of foundation of the church, led to this idea of the papacy and Peter being the first pope and apostolic succession up until now. And you would expect, since I'm not a Catholic priest, but a Baptist preacher, minister, pastor, whatever word you want to call me, that that would not be my interpretation of this text, and you would be correct. No surprise. So what is going on here? Well, I think one thing that will help us is to go back to where we started and remember where this is happening. Picture number two is a modern-day picture, actually from the Israel Ministry of Tourism. We didn't go there, so I couldn't have taken it. But it is a picture of Caesarea Philippi, that place where in the artist's rendition you saw the temple of, or the sanctuary of Pan. And on this picture you can see it's no longer a built-up place. There are actually ruins there. This picture's from a far enough distance that you can't really see the ruins. There are actually niches carved around the opening, but that is the cave that at one time had the sanctuary of Pan built in front of it. And it is in, because it's on the slopes of Mount Hermon, it is on about a 100-foot-tall rock face that this is happening. So what does Jesus say? You are now Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church. Why would he use that expression? I would suggest to you one reason is because he was looking at a rock on which there was a church. There was this big rock, and there was a church on it. How's that for thought? I don't know, just fascinating to me. That he's with his disciples overlooking this very pagan sanctuary. And I would imagine, because it was a very popular place, there were lots of people milling about. There were people coming there. It was kind of a major worship center. And this church was built on it, and they did some crazy things. I will not go into the details. But it's not nice. How's that? Sacrifices and fertility rites and sexual acts that happened as part of this sort of thing. This was a place that if you were a good disciple of Jesus, you didn't go here on the weekends. I was trying to think of like a modern day equivalent in our town, but I'd probably get in trouble, so I won't mention one nonetheless, because that's a kind of a weird way of thinking. But this is not a place the disciples would go hang out. In fact, this place would have been considered for a devout Jew a place to be avoided. It would be unclean. You don't go here. You avoid it. And Jesus takes his disciples here to a place where they stayed away from to say, listen, now that we've established who I am, now that you've made this confession of faith, I want you to know that upon this rock I will build my church. I think ultimately that's kind of got a double meaning. I think it means the confession of Peter, yes, but I think it means the apostolic beginnings of the church that we see in the book of Acts. That those men, the apostles, were the ones who proclaimed the gospel and the church rises out of them. I don't think it implies any sort of succession that others believe. And so they proclaim the gospel, the good news of the gospel of Jesus Christ, of forgiveness and salvation through him and him alone. And it was their call, I think, that Jesus wanted this as the backdrop, because he was saying, not even what? The gates of Hades. What did I say that cave was the entrance to? The underworld. In fact, some people would call it the gates of Hades. We say gates of hell sometimes. That he took them to the place that was widely known as the entrance to the underworld, with all this stuff happening as part of their pagan religious celebration, and said, I'm going to build my church on a rock, and it's going to overpower even what looks like this debauchery before you. See, that's one of the, I think, implicit messages in this encounter of Jesus with his disciples is to say, and what we talked about last week and what we need to be reminded of, the going of the Great Commission, that we're not supposed to say, okay, we are all good, godly people, and we're going to get together with other good, godly people, lest we run into those bad, ungodly people around us and they get dirt on us, they get their ick on us. No, we have been called by God, set apart by God and sent by God, and he took his disciples to a place they would have avoided at all costs and said, even what you've said, that gospel, the good news, you're this rock, that I am the Christ, the Son of the living God, not even this is going to stand in the face of that truth, that one day, now, we know one day meaning heaven, but as the disciples went out, as they were dispersed by the persecution that came, and they went all over the place, they encountered the less than Christian people and places. And they went there willingly to proclaim that message that Jesus was the Christ, the Son of the living God, the Messiah of God, the promise of God fulfilled in a person who died on the cross, who rose from the grave, and is the name given among men by which we must be saved. And as they proclaimed that, the church grew. God did, in fact, build his church upon the proclamation of the gospel that was begun by the apostles in the book of Acts. So that even today, while we see ruins at a place like this, we see churches filled all over our world, people worshiping, proclaiming the good news of the gospel of Jesus Christ. I will build my church upon this rock. I will build my church, and not even the worst places on earth you can imagine can stand against the truth and the power of that gospel. And then he says to Peter, and I will give you keys to the kingdom, which sounds exciting. You remember when your parents gave you the key to the car? You got your driver's license. First you had that learner's permit thing, and they always had to drive with you. And we as parents age 100 years in those 6 months. Anybody here have a new learner's permit child in their house? Oh, awesome. Shall we stop and pray? No. I know we have a few of our teens that have reached that magic number. And then after that year of learner's permit, you get your full-fledged license where you don't need the parental with you. They can give you the keys. Now we enjoyed that, by the way. Maybe some of you parents did too, because now we didn't have to take them everywhere. It was awesome. I needed some milk. Denise said, hey, Charles, go get me some milk. I said, hey, Caroline, go get me some milk. And then give it to your mom, because I don't need it, but she does. It's a beautiful thing. But there's that moment where, for the first time, your parents hand you the keys, and you get to go and take the family car, which you really don't want to take, because it's probably the familiest car out there, you know. You would rather, unless your parent has like a Corvette or something, and then you're like, yes, please, please, but they never give you those keys. Doesn't work that way. You know, we understand what keys do. In fact, in that day when he talks about keys to the kingdom, there were actually in the monarchy, there were chief stewards of the monarch who maintained access to the different parts of the monarch's residence, the palace, whatever it was, and access even to the monarch himself. And at times they would be the literal key carriers of the kingdom. You know, the king doesn't have to be bothered with a pocket full of keys. He can just kind of, if he wants something opened, he just calls somebody that opens it. But that steward of the monarch ultimately doesn't make the decisions on who gets in and gets out. He acts only under the authority of the monarch. He's not sovereign because he's got the keys. The keys are a symbol of the authority of the sovereign who trusts him to enact his will. And so a lot of people read these verses and say, I will give you keys to the kingdom. And whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. And there are whole theologies written about, you know, you can say bind that and loose that and bind that and loose that. And I think one of the problems is that's literally not what it says. And I use the word literally, which is very unusual. If you were to translate the tenses of these verbs literally, this is a literal translation of that passage. It says, whatever you bind on earth shall have been bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth shall have been loosed in heaven. Those of you who are grammar nuts could probably figure out what tense that is. I don't recall offhand. I meant to write it down, but I didn't. Let me read that again. Whatever you bind on earth shall have been bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth shall have been loosed on heaven. So loosed in heaven. So the idea is, if God has bound something, we're allowed to speak on behalf of the sovereign, recognizing the bound condition that God has placed that thing in. We don't go to the thing and say, hey, you're bound because I got all the power. See the keys? And we don't go to something else and say, you're loosed because I have the power. No, we are able to speak freedom or loosing to things that God has already loosed. We aren't the ones who bear the authority, but we're given responsibility in this kingdom under the authority of the sovereign to live in the way we do. And I think particularly what is in mind here, again, is the whole theme of this passage, is the gospel itself. It's the idea that the keys to the kingdom, what do keys do? Key to your house, what does it do? Get you in and out, right? If you got a key, you can get in. If you ain't got no key, that's good English right there, I'm telling you. Can't get in. If the door is locked, you are barred. You are bound, in other words, from entering in. But if you have the key, if the door has been opened, you are loosed, you are free to enter. And the gospel is, in effect, that thing which allows access. In fact, Jesus, in Luke chapter 11, talks to the leaders of Israel, and he says in verse 52, "Woe to you, experts in the law." Listen to this. "Because you have taken away the key to knowledge. You yourselves have not entered, and you have hindered those who were entering." He condemns the teachers of Israel because in their execution of the law, in their teaching of the law, they didn't know God. They had come so caught up in the specifics of just doing the right thing and following the letter of the law that they'd missed the bigger picture. And so their teaching was actually hindering people from understanding and entering into the kingdom. And he cries, woe to them. The keys to the kingdom is the access, the entry, and the gospel is that which allows us to enter the kingdom. And we, as we have the keys of the kingdom, when we preach, when we proclaim, those who God is working on, not by flesh or blood, but by the Spirit has revealed it and brings them to the realization of the truth, they are freed and loose to enter the kingdom, and we are allowed to preach in a way that they will respond. And others who God has not made that process real in will not, in fact, respond. It's not us that we outthink him or outlogic him. It's God's work that we just, under his authority, we work. And it's that is key. He says, I will build my church in the gates of hell will not prevail against it. You know, I missed a whole section of my notes. Do you want me to go back? It's the moment of truth. That says 10 o'clock. All in favor? No, I'm sorry. I don't want to know that. No votes. I'm going to do it real quick. It was upon this rock. By the way, you know, that's the thing. I said there's some controversy about it. There's the Catholic Church would say the Pope and all that sort of thing. Well, wouldn't it be great if, like, maybe Peter himself gave us something of his understanding of what the rock was? How many of you think Peter would be helpful in understanding what the rock meant? You should raise your hand now. Otherwise, I'm just going to pray and we're going to go home. Wait, no, that's not a good choice. No, okay, so 1 Peter chapter 2. Peter himself, later in his life, after he's done so many things for God and is part of the gospel, in 1 Peter chapter 2, beginning in verse 4, listen to what he writes. As you come to him, the living stone, that sounds like a rock. Who is him? Jesus. Why is he a living stone? Well, because all the other stone idols are dead. There's no life in him, but Jesus is alive. He was dead, but now he's alive. Rejected by men, chosen by God, and precious to him. You also, like living stones, are being built into a spiritual house to be a holy priesthood, offering spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. For in Scripture it says, see, I lay a stone in Zion, a chosen and precious cornerstone, and the one who trusts in him will never be put to shame. Now to you who believe, the stone is precious, but to those who do not believe, the stone the builders rejected has become the capstone, and a stone that causes men to stumble, and a rock that makes them fall. What do you think the rock was in that passage, the stone was? It's pretty clear, right? Peter came to understand the rock, the stone, the only one that really mattered was Jesus. It wasn't him. He doesn't assert his great authority. No, he points to Jesus, which is why when we started, I said, the most important question any of us will ever have to answer is the same one the disciples had to answer. Who is Jesus? Who is he? A lot of ways we can answer that question. A lot of ways people do answer that question. But ultimately, the way we answer the question makes the difference between life and death, between salvation and damnation, between heaven and hell, between eternity with God and eternity apart from God. Jesus said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." Who is Jesus? I believe he is the Word that was made flesh. He's the second person of the Trinity that took on human form. He was 100% God and 100% man. I don't know how the math works. I just believe that it's true. Who lived a sinless life on this earth. You and I, we all have sinned. All of us. I don't care how little you think it was big before a holy God. And it was enough to separate you from him and to write your sentence to eternal separation from God. But Jesus, he never did. He was tempted in every way as we are, but was without sin. And he set his face steadfastly toward Jerusalem. He knew what was coming. Yes, he was limited in some ways by the physical body that he was when he was Jesus, but there were other ways that his knowledge was very clear. And he knew when he headed toward Jerusalem and about his 33rd year to observe the Passover with his disciples, as he had done before, that this time he wasn't going just to leave a few days later. He was going to die. And he set his face steadfastly toward Jerusalem. And though he prayed in the garden, "If there's any way this cup can pass from me," he ended by saying, "Not my will, but yours be done." And he went to the cross. And even when they came to arrest him, do you remember this episode? I didn't write down this verse, but a remarkable thing. Jesus is in the garden. They come to arrest him. They ask him if he's Jesus, and he says, "I am," which is the holy name of God. And it says they all fall back. All the army just fall. Why is that? Because though he is a man, he is God. And in that moment, just a little bit of his glory seeped out. And I can't believe they got up and still arrested the man, but they did. I'd be like, "I'm out. See ya." You know, drop the mic moment. You're over. But they did. They arrest him. They try him. They did their best. They brought in false witnesses against him. They couldn't even get their story straight. Till finally the high priest, exasperated, asked him a question. Guess what Jesus says again? Same thing he said in the garden. "I am." And the high priest tears his robe because that's blasphemy. He's claimed to be God. "You've heard it. We don't need any more witnesses." They arrest him, beat him, put the crown of thorns on his head, make him carry his cross, which you can't even make it all the way to. They had to recruit help. Nail him, hands and feet. Leave him to die. And even in all of that, as you read the Old Testament, prophecy after prophecy after prophecy is fulfilled. The way he died, Psalm 22. The fact no bones were broken. All these things, right out of the Old Testament prophecy of who the Messiah is, the promised anointed one, the Messiah of God. And he dies. "Father, into your hands I commit my spirit." It is finished. Tetelestai. Some people say that means paid in full. And then the first Easter morning, as the women went to the tomb because they were sure Jesus was still dead. They were sure that was the end of the story. They see the stone has been rolled away and the tomb is empty. And they meet the angel. "Why do you look for the living among the dead? He is risen just as he said." And then a few weeks later, he ascends from the Mount of Olives to the right hand of the Father, where he's seated to this day, making intercession for us, so that whosoever calls upon the name of the Lord will be saved. And today, I'm going to ask you the question Jesus asked his disciples. Who do you say that Jesus is? And maybe if today, for the first time, you've come to understand he's more than just a good teacher. He's more than just a mythical figure of history, a miracle worker, or even a religious icon. If you've come to see him, as the Word that became flesh, as God incarnate, as the one who died on the cross for your sin, as the one who makes it possible to be restored to relationship with the God who created you in His image, I invite you to call upon that name, the name of Jesus, admitting your sin, confessing your need for a Savior, and receiving the salvation that comes through Him.